The next case before the court is something completely different. This is a criminal appeal filed by Troy Olivera, and the responding party is the state of Nevada through the Clark County District Attorney's Office. This case has a number of issues in it also, but it's limited to the 15 minutes just like the last case. So we'll go right into this, and do we have Ms. Hoja? How do you pronounce your name?
Good morning, Your Honor. Nadia Hoja.
Hoja. All right. And do you want to introduce your co-counsel, too?
Yes, Your Honor. This is Talia Walkinshaw. She was the first chair at the trial stage.
Oh, okay. Welcome to both of you. And you have the 15 minutes. Do you want to save any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Ms. Hoja, go ahead.
May it please the court, my name is Nadia Hoja. Your Honors, there are two entirely separate and distinct reasons why this case should be reversed. One is for structural error under Batson, and the second is for prejudicial error for multiple other issues that occurred during the trial. I'm going to start by talking about some of the prejudicial error, and then I'll talk about the Batson error. In this case, a presumptive instruction was given to the jury, instruction number 8, which read that every person who unlawfully breaks and enters or unlawfully enters any house may reasonably be inferred to have broken and entered or entered it with intent to commit larceny, unless the unlawful breaking and entering or unlawful entry is explained by evidence satisfactory to the jury to have been made without criminal intent. This is a presumption instruction. It's a permissive presumption. Well, our position is that the first part of the instruction is a permissive presumption. The second part of the instruction turns it into a mandatory presumption. But it is a presumption instruction. So I want to start by talking about NRS 47.2303, because that statute says that any time a presumption instruction is given, the court shall give a follow-up instruction. Follow-up instruction was never given in this case. Under the Hollis case, that is reversible error on its own. There's no disputing the instruction was not given in this case, and Hollis clearly states the presumption instruction is given, and the instruction pursuant to NRS 47.2303 is not given, that is reversible error. In this case, that error cannot be harmless, because the evidence in this case was not overwhelming by any means. The jury deliberated for almost 7 hours in this case, Your Honors, and intent was the sole issue in the case. This was a one-count burglary case in which the defense conceded identity and conceded that property was eventually taken after the entry. Intent upon entry was the sole issue. When the jury instructions dealing with intent are improper and the jury is out for almost 7 hours, the error cannot be found to be harmless. I do want to talk about instruction number.
I don't know that we count, though, the jury time for deliberation. What if the jury was out for 15 minutes? What would we say then?
Well, when the court is looking to determine whether error is harmless, the quantum of evidence and whether the evidence is overwhelming is a factor that the court can consider. In this case, because there was only one issue they could have been deliberating over, the amount of time that it took them is indicative of the fact that they had issues with finding Mr. Olivera guilty.
Well, I think, his question is, that's a dangerous road to go down because you never know what goes on in a jury room. We don't even look in the jury room because that's their domain and what they're talking about, whether they, are really hashing over something or whether they're really slow, whether they wanted to stay for free dinner or something. We don't get into that. So it's kind of a dangerous argument because, as you point out, it could go the other way. What if it's a five-minute verdict? Does that mean the evidence is overwhelming? Well, not necessarily, right? Unless that's the argument you're making.
I would certainly submit to the court that the court can take into consideration the amount of time. If the court chooses not to, that is at the court's discretion. But when we're looking at a harmless error analysis, the totality of the circumstances are looked at, including the evidence in the case. And whether the jury had difficulty reaching a verdict, whether jury notes were sent, which a jury note was sent in this case.
I did want to mention that we received your supplemental authorities that were filed also by Ms. Dickinson. And I forgot to mention that Judge Abby Silver is participating in this case. She regrets she couldn't be here today, and she will be listening to the recording.
Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to talk about instruction number 8 a little bit.
That's a class bill.
Yeah. I've already mentioned that instruction number 8 is the defense submits. Part 1 is a permissive presumption, but part 2 becomes a mandatory presumption. And the Deal case, which we did cite to in our supplemental points in authorities lays out the distinction when we see that unless clause, the second part, everything that comes after the unless, turns the instruction into a mandatory presumption rather than a permissive presumption. And the Diehl court held that unless the clause, the unless clause does not merely require some evidence from the defense, but rather requires the defense to produce.
Well, what makes this mandatory when the instruction says may reasonably be inferred? It doesn't say must.
It's the unless clause. It's the second part. The first part we concede is a permissive presumption, and that's the part that's always been ruled on by the Nevada Supreme Court in previous opinions. An objection has never been launched to the second part, the part that comes after the unless. We did specifically object to it at the trial level in this case. Everything that comes after the unless shifts the burden. It now requires that evidence satisfactory to the jury be presented that Mr. Olivera entered without criminal intent.
Well, but if the first part has the may in it, that means the jury doesn't have to do it. If they don't do it, you don't even get to the unless clause, right?
Well, the Diehl court lays out why that doesn't work. Basically, they say that because the instruction is read to the jury as a whole, when the jury sees that second clause, they now think that there's a condition precedent on whether it's mandatory or permissive. The unless creates a burden for us of making it permissive. We now have to present a quantum of evidence that's undefined. No jury instruction is given as to what evidence satisfactory to the jury is.
So let me, if I can rephrase your argument, you're essentially saying because of the word unless in the second clause, this would be the exact same instruction if that word in the first clause were must. Must, you're saying this would be the exact same instruction if that said must, that that may has no impact whatsoever because it's nullified by the unless?
We're saying that everything that comes after the unless and everything after it, yes, nullifies the first part and turns it into a mandatory presumption. We're saying that had there been a period before the word unless and that entire second clause was missing, it would be a permissive presumption and it would be a proper instruction, but the unless and everything that comes after nullifies it, makes it mandatory, makes it unconstitutional, shifts the burden to the defense to provide evidence, which is not our burden. The state has the burden of proving every element, and this instruction shifts that unconstitutionally. It doesn't define what evidence satisfactory to the jury is.
Well, here's the question. You're saying there's two words in here. There's a may and there's an unless. You're saying the unless trumps the may. Well, why is that the inference? Why isn't it that the may trumps the unless?
Because the unless creates the impression of a condition precedent, which is what the Diehl court lays out. The Diehl court found made the exact same finding. It's not binding on this court, obviously. It's from another jurisdiction. But it is persuasive authority the court can look to. And precisely, what our argument here is precisely what the Diehl court said, which is that the first part is absolutely fine. It's a permissive presumption. The second part becomes a mandatory presumption. It creates a condition precedent on the first part being permissive. It's shifting the burden to the defense. The defense has to provide evidence now, and it's an undefined quantum of evidence.
And that's instructions based upon a statute. Are you asking the court to rule the statute unconstitutional then?
We are asking the court to rule that the instruction that should be given should stop before the unless. The period should be before unless.
Just put a period and strike the rest.
Yes. And I would further point out that the second part of the instruction also says that the defense has to prove that he entered without criminal intent, which is an improper statement of the burglary statute. At this point, the jury was instructed that the state had to show that he entered with the intent to commit larceny, but we have to show he entered with absolutely no criminal intent. That's what the instruction that they received said. That's not accurate. He could have entered with the intent to commit trespass, and it wouldn't be a burglary. But the way that instruction is phrased and the way that instruction is worded, it puts a higher burden on the defense than it does on the state.
What about the way it was argued by the trial attorneys? Wouldn't that point have been made clear of what you just said, what the state really had to prove? I mean, was the jury misled in any way? Did the state somehow misuse this instruction?
We're not positing that the state misused this instruction, or that we, although we did put forward that prosecutorial misconduct occurred in this case in the way that the reasonable doubt instruction was argued. But at the end of the day, the instruction that comes with from the judge is very different from the arguments of counsel. This isn't a misstatement of law that counsel can then get up there and say, well, the judge gave you the wrong law. You should follow what we say, not what the judge said. That just wasn't a remedy that was available to the defense. We objected to this instruction. We specifically objected to that second clause. Seeing that I have only 1 minute left, I did want to talk about Batson a little bit.
Go ahead.
In this case, Your Honors, the court allowed the state to strike two African-American jurors. The defense objected under Batson, stating that these jurors were being struck based on their race. After the state stated their race-neutral reasons, the defense then pointed to similarly situated Caucasian jurors who were not struck for the same reasons. Looking to Ms. Brown, the state cited eye contact and having a pending DUI. The defense was able to point to similarly situated jurors in both that had the same exact issues, jurors that were not making eye contact with the state, Ms. Barra and Mr. Nussdorf, and a juror that had multiple DUI convictions and multiple possession of marijuana convictions, Mr. Harrington.
Did any of them have pending criminal cases?
No, not pending. Mr. Harrington was already convicted. So even more than pending. Pending is there's still a presumption of innocence. There's a possibility this person didn't do it. Mr. Harrington had four convictions at least that we know of, and he wasn't struck by the state. Furthermore, going to the short bus comment that the state gave as a reason for striking Ms. Brown, I would point to the fact that, one, the state didn't ask her a single question, as outlined under Diamampo, when we look to see why the state has struck a juror and whether it's pretextual or whether there is truly a race-neutral reason behind it. And I'd like to read the quote, full quote, and then I'm going to sit down because I did want to reserve time for rebuttal. The full quote was, "Hi, I'm badge number 240. My name is Dawn Brown. I actually have two jobs. I work for the school district as a transportation aide on the short bus, and I'm a house parent at a group home. I'm divorced from a long time ago. I have five children. I have a 20-year-old son, a 19-year-old daughter, a 17-year-old daughter, and twin girls. They're 12. The state said that this demonstrated a lack of decorum and that she was clearly making fun of intellectually disabled children. That quote. That was the race-neutral reason here.
Well, that certainly sounds strange, but don't we have to defer, though, to the trial court? The judge is there interacting with everyone and can see exactly what's happening, and we're listening to you reading a piece of paper, and we're not watching it.
We don't have tone of voice. We don't have, you know, sarcasm. We can't even tell that.
And, Your Honor, actually, the McCarty court lays out that the trial court has an obligation to do a sensitive inquiry into all relevant circumstances before making a ruling under Batson. And in McCarty, which is a case just released by the Nevada Supreme Court, they said that the district court failed to address which facts and circumstances alleviated its concerns, and then McCarty applied de novo review. Because they said where the district court fails to do a sensitive inquiry, the appellate court gets de novo review. And that's precisely what we're asking for here, because the district court completely failed to make any record as to Ms. Brown. Literally, she didn't say a single thing about Ms. Brown. She simply said, I find the state has presented race-neutral reasons. She didn't even go into whether she found they were pretextual or genuine. And then she moved on. And she referred to the fact that she was trying to get this done in 15 minutes twice, which is precisely an issue that the Connor court pointed out when they reversed the Connor case. And with that, I really do want to reserve some time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Hojet. Thank you. You have 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Cooper, if you could introduce yourself and your co-counsel also.
Yes, Your Honor. My co-counsel and who is lead counsel in this case is Alicia Albrin, who sits to my left. May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Cooper, and I'm a deputy district attorney, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the Clark County District Attorney's Office. I would first like to address the issues as it related to jury instruction number 8, as pointed out by the appellant. Specifically, I would point out to the court, as this court is fully aware, that jury instruction number 8 comes directly from NRS 205.065. It was a direct, quote from that statute. That statute does, in fact, have that unless clause, as the defense claims is at issue here. The state obviously does not believe that unless clause is at issue, primarily because of the May wording in that this does not become a mandatory finding of intent. It becomes more of a permissible instruction and just generally an information as the jury can use to determine whether or not somebody had the intent needed to be convicted of burglary as they entered that building. This statute actually has been upheld several times by the Nevada Supreme Court, specifically in McNeely v. Estate, which the cite to that is 81 NEV 663. The pinpoint site is 667, where the Supreme Court specifically said statutory establishment of inferences such as NRS 205.065 have been held by the United States Supreme Court as being constitutionally permissive. And that's coming directly out of that case where the Nevada Supreme Court did uphold the statute. Specifically, they also addressed the statute in Aaron v. State, where the appellant claims that they actually didn't address the statute. They did, where while they do go on to explain why the issue is somewhat moot because the issue was addressed on a writ, the Nevada Supreme Court does explicitly say, even if we assume he is entitled to, again, advocate these positions, we do deem them to be without merit. And they were referring specifically to the claims that NRS 205.065 was unconstitutional. The Nevada Supreme Court has held it being constitutional because it is a permissive instruction, not a mandatory finding of what the jury needs to do. And it was a correct statement as laid out in jury instruction number 8. It was properly given. So I believe that that issue is should be denied.
Well, just because something's based on a statute doesn't mean that it's a permissible instruction. I mean, we find, you know, appellate courts in general find statutes to be ambiguous all the time. There's tons of statutes. So if a statute can be ambiguous, if something written by the legislature can be ambiguous as a matter of law, then wouldn't an instruction based on that statute be inherently ambiguous?
It would be, Your Honor, but I don't think that's the case in this matter. I don't think the statute or jury instruction number 8 is ambiguous in any way. It does specifically lay out that the jury may reasonably infer and gives the conduct in which they may reasonably infer. I don't think there's anything ambiguous about the statute, nor do I think the Nevada Supreme Court thought anything was ambiguous about the statute in its decision, either Aaron or McNeely. And I would also point out that the appellant does cite to the Adams case, where they say the new train of thought related to entering a building with the intent to commit a burglary. They cite the Adams case, which is a more recent Supreme Court opinion. But the Adams case has no bearing on this case, as the facts are completely different. In the Adams case, that individual was entering a public building. It was a supermarket. He enters a public supermarket during normal business hours. So obviously, that's completely different than breaking and entering when you knowingly and voluntarily just enter a building during normal business hours. You obviously can easily have a different intent than someone who is breaking and entering into a building they have no permission to be into, and they actually break in through a second-story window. So I believe the Adams case is
essentially your argument is this is based on a statute and therefore it's a good instruction, but here's where I'm going with this, and I know neither of you briefed it. In State versus White, which was issued about a year and a half ago, the Supreme Court said breaking is not actually an element of the crime of burglary, but the statute has the word breaking in it. So essentially, the Supreme Court has written out a requirement of the statute. So if this statute has been revised by the Supreme Court judicially, then and your instruction is literally the statute, isn't that kind of an invalid instruction?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, because my understanding of the case just cited by this court was that it was referring specifically to burglary, not having you do not have to break and enter to actually commit a burglary. This inference instruction refers to when someone does, in fact, break and enter. So I think there is somewhat of a distinction, because this inference instruction and the burglary statute are, while they're next to each other, they are different statutes. This is the burglary statute is 205.060, and this inference instruction is 205.065, which specifically says, we understand that you don't have to break and enter to commit a burglary, as you can do that to a target for the intent to commit a grand larceny or some sort, but if you do break and enter, that shows your intent as when you're entering. This refers specifically to when someone breaks and enters versus the requirement that you need to break and enter to commit a burglary. So I think it is different. And as this court is fully aware, I believe when someone does break into someone else's home and they do not have permission to be there, there is somewhat circumstantial evidence that they broke and entered their home for an intent, an unlawful purpose, to wit, a larceny in this case.
I think that case Judge Tao was referring to was the one that the person was convicted of burglary, but the Supreme Court said you can't burglarize your own home.
Yeah, that's the one.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. And I believe that the factual, that case was not cited in the briefing, but from my knowledge of that case, I believe the factual scenario was a little bit different, as he entered his own home with an intent to commit a crime to a family member of some sort, which I think is a lot different when you're entering someone else's home and you actually break into a second-story window. Obviously, you had no intent to be there, and you had no reason to be there other than an unlawful purpose, and this was not his own home.
So Ms. Hojap pointed out that there was one count of burglary. That was the only charge. Lengthy jury deliberation. Defendant admits everything, intents that issue. apparently he wasn't actually charged with theft then. I assume that the value of the property stolen then was probably minimal.
Yes, Your Honor. So the factual pattern was that some items were actually found in the defendant's pocket. However, those items were less than, I believe, $650 at the time in order to rise to the level of a grand larceny. There were a lot of items that actually were found in a bag in one of the rooms next to the window in which the defendant was entered. And we believe, and the evidence supported, that he was actually interrupted in his burglary and was unable to actually retrieve those items from the house. Because they were never retrieved, we did not upgrade to a grand larceny type of crime. So he was only charged with the burglary because he entered with the intent to commit that crime, as shown by the fact that several items were by the window, and as shown by the fact that he did have some items in his pocket when he left the residence and subsequently ran from the police.
So she really wanted to highlight the intent issue. Do you agree then that that really was the only issue in front of the jury?
I believe the evidence in this case was clear cut, and I believe the jury did not have any issue as it related to the issues in this case. The defendant was found in the house by someone that was easily able to identify him. They specifically said he had no permission to be in the home. There was no reason for him to be in the home. He claims that he entered the house. To police, he claimed that he entered the house because he was trying to reconcile with his girlfriend. However, there was evidence to support that he actually knew his girlfriend's schedule. So, presumptively, he would have actually known his girlfriend would not have been home at the time because they did date for a significant period of time. He actually had been in the house before. And the evidence, as the state saw, he actually knew their schedule, which actually made them the perfect victims of his crime. And I believe the jury saw that as well. He also went directly to the parents' room, and the parents' room was ransacked. Obviously, going into a parents' room has no bearing as to whether or not you're trying to reconcile with your girlfriend. He came in through the window, as the evidence showed, that he actually entered through a second-story window, ripped the screen off the window, and entered that way. And then when he's actually caught, he subsequently runs from the police. I believe all that evidence was looked at by the jury. And as this court said, I have no reason why the jury deliberated as long as they did. I actually don't know if they deliberated 7 hours. I didn't see that in the record. But obviously, if appellant is saying that, I have to take her word for it. But I don't know how long they actually deliberated, nor do I know why they would have deliberated as long as they did, if they did deliberate that long.
Well, just to finish on that instruction, does the word unless make this a fatally flawed instruction?
The state does not believe so, Your Honor. The state believes that the word may in the instruction does specifically say the jury does not have to do this. The word may, that's obviously common knowledge as to what that word means. Obviously, if the word was must, and it was an instruction that the jury was mandated to follow, I believe that would, in fact, make it an impermissible instruction. And those types of instructions have subsequently been found invalid by the Nevada Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court. However, this instruction was, in fact, found valid on the two cases I cited by the Nevada Supreme Court. And it was because that it is a permissive instruction, not a mandatory instruction.
Well, burglary is a specific intent crime. What's interesting about this statute, which is a question I've actually thought about for a few years now, you can make the argument that read literally, this statute says that if there's a breaking and entering, you can infer from that alone that there's intent. That's general intent. This is almost saying that burglary is a general intent crime. At least you can read it this way. What's your response to that?
And yeah, I don't believe that. I read it as this categorizing burglary as a general intent crime. I believe this statute only allows for the jury. It gives the jury an additional instruction as it relates to how to be able to articulate what circumstantial evidence is. I believe the breaking and entering as described in NRS 205.065 just refers to if someone breaks and enters into a building they have no reason to be in, that is one of the elements that could be used to you to infer what their intent was as they were entering that building. I just think it goes directly to the circumstantial intent instruction, and I believe that's the only inference or the only intent that the legislative used, and that's the only way we argued it at the trial level, was that this is just another factor to consider. Why else would someone break and enter into a building if they did not want to steal stuff inside of it? And that's how it was argued. Going just very briefly, because I have 4 minutes, onto the Batson issue. Obviously, Your Honor, this court is fully aware of the standard, the three-prong test. The only prong I'll talk about is the third prong because the state did offer its race-neutral reasoning. Specifically addressing the two different jurors that the appellant had issue with that we struck, focusing first on Ms. Brown. Ms. Brown was the individual who actually made the short bus comment. I actually fully understood what she meant by short bus. In my understanding, there's only one way you can actually use the term short bus, and I took that to be derogatory in the sense of she said she was an aide on a bus, and it was the short bus. I don't remember her exact wording. In my own personal experience, I know individuals that ride the short bus do have mental handicaps or mental disabilities or learning disabilities, if you will. So when she actually referred to the fact that she used the short bus instead of saying, I work with mentally handicapped children or I work with mentally impaired children, I took that to be offensive, especially given the fact that I have a family member that rode the quote-unquote short bus. So I did personally take that to be offensive, which was why one of the main reasons she was kicked. And the second reason she was kicked was she does have a pending DUI case. They made reference to juror Mr. Henderson, I think juror number 304, where they said he has four convictions. I actually went through the record. He only had three prior cases. One was an arrest for a DUI, and two were marijuana arrests. They occurred 30 years ago in Canada. So obviously he's in a completely different situation than someone that currently has a pending DUI case that's open. And not only does she have a pending DUI case that's open, she actually works in the transportation industry. So she would obviously know the importance of not driving while intoxicated. That was another concerning factor to the state. She also made no eye contact, and the appellant says, oh, there was other individuals that made no eye contact. Just because the appellant saw other individuals not making eye contact with me does not mean I saw them not making eye contact with me, so I don't believe that's a valid reason. And all of this in general needs to be looked at in the totality of the circumstances as it relates to whether or not the state was being, I guess, prejudicial or discriminatory when it was striking these two African-American jurors. And the court has specifically laid out factors to include the demeanor of the prosecutors, the reasonableness of their expectations when they're actually doing their strikes, and what is rational as a basis of accepted trial status strategy. The only African-Americans that were in that courtroom were myself, my co-counsel, and the three jurors. And for the appellant to come now and say that myself and my co-counsel were being racist against our own race, I find very offensive.
Well, I don't think that's what the test is. I mean, just because you're a minority doesn't mean you don't want minorities on the jury, because minorities, certain types of minorities, are there is a correlation. We're getting a sociological thing. It's always dangerous to talk about, but there is a belief that certain types of minorities have a different view of the police than other types of minorities, and the fact that you yourself are a minority doesn't have anything to do with that belief, which is a race or at least a socioeconomically based belief. Do you understand my point?
I do, Your Honor, but I do think it goes directly to the heart of the Batson issue, because my understanding of Batson and the rationale behind Batson was that predominantly Caucasian prosecutors were striking African Americans in the South at the point, because Batson was obviously v. Kentucky, because of the proposition of what this court just stated. Now, obviously, when categorizing what my race-neutral reasons were, I think the court should also take into consideration whether or not I would have some purposeful bias against African-Americans. And obviously, I do not. And I think the demeanor of the prosecutor as they lay out their race-neutral reasons is a factor that was laid out by the Nevada Supreme Court to be considered, and I believe demeanor does also include the race of the prosecutor.
Does the recent case that they just filed in their supplemental authorities, McCarty, came out this year where the Nevada Supreme Court once again emphasized the importance of not striking people because of their race? Does that change anything about how this case progressed?
Yeah, it doesn't. Because in the McCarty case, I actually had an opportunity to read, it was a little bit of a different situation. In that case, essentially the person that was struck because she was actually a stripper. And does the court want me to finish my point?
Go ahead. Yes, please.
She was struck because she was a stripper, and just being a stripper alone, there's no rational connection between being a stripper and subsequently being improper juror for a criminal case. And I believe that's what the McCarty court was saying, specifically because the state's proposition at trial was that she was a stripper, that's why she's being struck. And then on appeal, the proposition was, we're actually striking her because she, her brother was a criminal and was prosecuted by her office. I also think that goes directly to what the court was saying, in that the fact that the prosecutors changed the rationale from the trial level to the appellate level shows that there might have been some pretextual striking in that case. In this case, it's been the same rationale throughout. The short bus comment, the fact that she had a pending DUI, and the other individual was a paralegal for a predominant defense attorney in town. Those are the reasons they were struck, and they would have been struck no matter what their race was. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cooper. All right, Ms. Kojak, you have a short rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And, Your Honor, going directly to the comment Your Honor just made to Mr. Cooper about why African-American individuals might still strike African-American jurors, during the state's voir dire in this case, they stood up, they asked the general panel two questions, then they singled out Ms. Smith, the African-American juror, and asked her, how do you feel like you were treated by police? And she's the only juror who was ever asked that question during voir dire. And then, even after she said she felt like she was treated fine by police, they struck her. They claim that they struck her because she was Mason Polsky's secretary.
Well,
they didn't
ask
her a single question about
that. That is a complicated issue, and it's becoming more and more complicated with the way society is going, right? Tiger Woods ends up on a jury. What is he? Barack Obama ends up on a jury. His mom is Caucasian. His dad is from Africa. What's he, right? And so the question here is, okay, if you single out people because they have a negative view of law enforcement, okay, that's a legitimate grounds. We all know that. There's a million cases that say that. But there is a correlation between your view of the police and your race. That's just a fact of life. There's a ton of studies that say that. So when you strike someone for having negative attitudes about the police, are you striking them because they're a minority that has a negative attitude or because they individually have a negative attitude? It's kind of an interesting question.
It is an interesting question, and it's a big picture question. But it's not a question we need to address in this case because she specifically said she didn't have a negative view of police. She, in fact, said the opposite. She said she had a positive view of police. And she got struck, and I'd like to read the court, the standard in Diamanto. Diamanto specifically said, the factors that they look to, did the DA question the juror about the reasons that they then struck the juror? Did the DA move to strike the juror for cause prior to exercising a peremptory challenge on the juror? Could the state possibly plausibly conclude the stated reason of their challenge from the exchange they had with the individual during voir dire? Neither juror was asked a single question about the reasons that were then given for striking them. Mr. Yampolsky's secretary was explicitly told, we don't want you to talk about your experiences with Macy Yampolsky. We're asking you a question outside of that. Don't answer that. She was never asked, has this shaped your view of the criminal justice system? Has this shaped your view of the state? Has this influenced the way that you might possibly be fair during a trial? She was never asked any of the questions that Diamanto gives us guidance is what we look to determine whether a strike was whether a stated reason is pretextual or not.
But Mr. Cooper gave race-neutral reasons, and the district court found that was sufficient. What about the third part of the test?
The district court, may I finish, Your Honor?
Go ahead.
The district court did not make a finding on either. The district court stated the state has given race-neutral reasons. That's prong two. The district court did not make a finding under prong three for Ms. Brown at all. She didn't say a single word about Ms. Brown, and all she said
about the first factor, what did the defense show that it was a race-based strike?
Is the court talking about showing the pattern?
Right. I mean, you have the first part. It's initially the burden is upon the defendant to show it was race-based.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then the state responds.
Our burden is to show it was race-based, and we showed that two of three African-American jurors were struck using two. So basically 66% of the panel was struck using less than 50% of their strikes. Under the case, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name, but we did cite to it in our brief, that looks at the analysis of what percentage of the minority is struck from the panel. 66%, over 50% of the panel was struck using their two peremptory challenges.
So what if the prosecutor had not been Mr. Cooper, but someone else, let's say a Caucasian male, would there be any difference here?
There's no difference. The ethnicity of the prosecutor makes no difference when we're doing a Batson analysis. The analysis we're looking at under Batson is about whether or not they're trying to keep people of a certain ethnicity off of the jury. As Judge Tao said, that the race of the prosecutor doesn't make an effect on that because African-American prosecutors can absolutely try to keep African-American jurors off of their jury, and that's still a due process violation, and it's still structural error. There's not an exception for African-American prosecutors.
All right, thank you, Ms. Hojet.
Thank you.
Both counsel did an excellent job. Thank you very much for coming here today. This matter will stand submitted to the court for a decision at a later time. And again, Judge Silver will be participating in the decision of the